This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
There are a lot of things that I would rather do than wait. Recently, we've been waiting for cold air to get here as summer has lasted, in my opinion, about a month or two too long. Waiting is difficult. And our culture is filled with different ideas about what's involved with waiting. So one line of reasoning says good things come to those who wait. And so there's pushback to that. Like Napoleon Hill, he wrote a real famous business book called Think and Grow Rich. He said, don't wait. The time will never be just right. The famous Hollywood star Ashton Kutcher agrees. He says, I don't believe that old cliche that good things come to those who wait. I think good things come to those who want something so bad they can't sit still. Maybe there's a middle ground. JCPenney, who founded JCPenney, said, I learned that all things come to those who wait, provided they hustle while they wait. And so bring us full circle with a God-centered view. Nancy Lee DeMoss says, the truth is that contentment is not found in having everything we think we want, but in choosing to be satisfied with what God has already provided. The truth is that those of us who insist on having their own way often end up with unnecessary heartache, while those who wait on the Lord always get His best. So no matter where you are on that spectrum or trying to think through this issue of waiting, we all probably agree that waiting is difficult. And so we jump back into 2 Samuel this morning, and we're caught up in a waiting game. Way back in 1 Samuel 16, Samuel had anointed David, a man of God's own choosing, to be king over Israel. But no matter what David did, it seemed the kingdom was slow in coming. It was a waiting game. David learned to trust God, and he was leaning into contentment. And as 2 Samuel begins, Saul has died, and David has mourned for him, and you'd think that, well, now it's time. You know, the next in line is David. He's the one who's anointed king. He'll become king over the nation. But last time, when we were in chapter 2, following God's leading, David had moved to Hebron, and was made king over the house of Judah, not over the entire nation. And he had to deal with all kinds of people trying to speed up God's timing. All kinds of people who weren't interested in waiting, who were ready to just win the battle now, and let's just get this over with. You'll become king. And that's really where we're caught in 2 Samuel 3 and 4, because next week in chapter 5, David will become king over all of Israel. So my purpose today then is to help us learn something when we're frustrated with the waiting. That's really what chapters 3 and 4 are about. So are you good at waiting? Are you growing in patience the longer you live as God's working in you? So lest you think, well, that's preposterous. Why would I be growing in patience? Well, because the fruit of the Spirit is what? Love, joy, patience. So it seems like that if the Spirit dwells in you, that's the fruit that He's going to be perfecting in your life is patience. James actually encourages us in the New Testament to let patience have its perfect work. So there's work that patience needs to do, and we're to like explore letting that happen. So knowing these parts of the Bible help us see that God's heart is that we'd be drawn into contentment, that we'd be drawn into waiting, that we'd be drawn into patience, and all of this can mean a long, often difficult road. You might even have a refrigerator magnet with something about waiting from Isaiah 40, right? Those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall walk and not grow weary. Maybe that's not how it goes. They shall run and not grow weary. They shall walk and not faint. So maybe that's on your refrigerator. And it's just encouraging us to wait. And the great thing about waiting is there's hope, right? You may think, well, this is impossible. How do I grow in patience? And I'm not going to dare pray that because I don't want God to begin to teach me what it would look like for me to be more patient. But God is patient, right? God is slow to anger. He's abounding in loving kindness. He reeks of patience. He's put up with sinners like you and me and all the generations before us for a long time. So there's hope and there's help for us in Him. He can change us from the inside out that we may live for Him and not live for our small agendas. I mean, that's really the issue, right? The reason we're so impatient a lot of the time is because we just want things our way. We're not willing to lean into what God's way is. We just want it now. Like, we want this now. It's my agenda. I want this thing. Therefore, I'm impatient and I'm not going to wait. I'm not going to, like, why would I do that? Why would I slow down the process when God's given me these promises? Well, you're just like David, right? This is exactly where we're at today in this passage. So I invite you to join me as we dig into 2 Samuel again. And we're going to see three lessons that we can learn waiting for the Lord's timing. Three lessons that we can learn waiting for the Lord's timing. And let's begin by reading verses 1 through 5 just to get into chapter 3. Here's what we read there. And this is 2 Samuel 3, verses 1 through 5. There was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew stronger and stronger while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. And sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam of Jezreel, and his second, Kileab of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel, and the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur, and the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith, and the fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital, and the sixth, Ithream of Eglah, David's wife. These were born to David in Hebron. This is God's word. Thanks be to God. So that gets us into the chapter. Three lessons that we can learn as we wait for the Lord's timing. And the first lesson that we can learn as we wait is that we should aim for peace. We should aim for peace. So we're brought up to speed in those opening verses that there's a war going on, a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. David's growing stronger. Saul's growing weaker. And we're told about all these children that were born. Now, last time when we spoke of David appealing to the men of Jabesh to fight for him like they did for Saul, I suggested that what David was doing there was walking in the sphere of James 3 wisdom. And so we saw that. You might remember that conduct in keeping with such wisdom was being peaceable with a harvest of righteousness sown in peace by those who make peace. That's how James 3:18 ends. And we see that here in David's life, that he's sowing peace and there's a harvest of peace as he's trying to make peace. And the section really begins there in verse 1 with that summary. David's waiting for God to act. And in the midst of the waiting, the house of David's growing stronger and the house of Saul's growing weaker. We're told in verses 2 through 5 that there's more and more children being born to David. And you might read this and think, well, man, that's great. He's having all kinds of kids. But what if I told you, like, that it was through six wives? Would you think that should be normative for Christian people like us? Is that, like, what you long for your kids? Man, I hope they can get another wife soon and have more kids for me. I hope they can connect with someone that really makes them happy and add that onto their list. And then there's the whole concubine thing that we'll get into later. So this, we shouldn't read verses 2 through 5 and think, wow, what a great guy. This is great. He's got a great big family. We should think, man, this kind of isn't how a king should be acting according to Deuteronomy 17. And hopefully, anytime you think about how a king should be acting, especially in the nation of Israel, you're looking at Deuteronomy 17. And Deuteronomy 17:17 warns against taking multiple wives. And we have six listed here in verses 2 through 5. And I know what most of you guys are thinking, like, hey, one wife's enough for me. What's David doing with six? And you should just smell there's trouble brewing here. We know this is going to get David into trouble down the road. So this is pointing to that. So with David's house getting stronger, We're told of someone making himself strong in the house of Saul, and that's the person of Abner. So let's read this section, beginning in verse 6. While there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone in to my father's concubine?" Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David, and yet you charge me today with a fault concerning a woman? God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba." And Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. And Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, "To whom does the land belong? Make your covenant with me. And behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all Israel to you." And David said, "Good, I'll make a covenant with you, but one thing I require of you, that is, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face." Then David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me my wife Michal, for whom I paid the bridal price of 100 foreskins of the Philistines." And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband Paltiel, the son of Laish. But her husband went with her, weeping after her all the way to Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, "Go, return." And he returned. And Abner conferred with some of the elders of Israel, saying, "For some time past you have been seeking David as king over you. Now then, bring it about, for the Lord has promised David, saying, 'By the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies.'" Abner also spoke to Benjamin, and then Abner went to tell David at Hebron all that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin thought good to do. We're almost done with this section. When Abner came with 20 men to David at Hebron, David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, "I will arise and go and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you and that you may reign over all that your heart desires." So David sent Abner away and he went in peace. Remember, that's the big heading. The first lesson we can learn as we wait is to try to make peace, to be a peacemaker. So, Abner and Ishbosheth were told of Saul's concubine, Rizpah. And I don't know if I can really explain a concubine in this room as much. I just hope that you know what a concubine is. So it was a woman at the service of the king. And Ishbosheth accuses Abner of going into her. And this is a problem because Abner would be stealing something that belongs to the king. And it's a problem for other reasons too, but I think you can figure those out. I think Ishbosheth's issue is this is the king's property. Now, it's hard to make sense in the text here. There's two interpretations, right? Right? He's either guilty or innocent. So, is he putting up all this fuss because he's guilty and therefore he's angry that his sin was found out? Or is he innocent and he's angry that he's been falsely accused? The text doesn't really make it clear, and so you just would have to choose one of those. But regardless, Abner is fired up from this. And he says, "Am I a dog's head to Judah?" He says, you know, listen to what he's saying here. "Am I not the one that is holding all this together? God do so to me and more if I don't accomplish for David what the Lord has said." Which makes us wonder, like, why have you been not doing what the Lord has said? For a couple chapters, right? Now all of a sudden, it's all on you? So he says to Ishbosheth, "David, not you, Ishbosheth, David is going to be king from Dan to Beersheba." And if you look on your map, you can see Dan is the northernest point and Beersheba is the southernest point. He's saying that no matter where Israel is, David's going to be king of that entire country. And of course, Ishbosheth is fearful at this point because this guy is just out of control. So the story shifts then to Abner and David. Abner sends a message to David saying, to whom does this land belong? And I'm sure David wants to write back and say, God. But Abner's saying, listen, it's me. It's Abner's to give. I'm the one holding all this together. I'm the one with the power here. And so he invites David into a covenant and promises that he will bring all of Israel to David. And David seems agreeable, but he asks for wife number one back. That would make seven wives, according to what the text says. So to undercut Abner, who does he contact to get wife number one back? He writes a letter to Ishbosheth, or he communicates with Ishbosheth for Michal. But so Ishbosheth takes Michal away from a husband who obviously loves her, right? He comes weeping after her. And Michal turns into just this political pawn that David's just grabbing so that it's a political move, so that all the house of Saul can see David's really blood. He's married to Michal. Why wouldn't you want to support him? And so when we get to 2 Samuel 6 and you're wondering, like, what's Michael's sorry attitude for? Well, it's kind of the way she's been handled here in chapter 3. That's part of it. Remember, of all these wives, Michael's the one who loved him. That's what 1 Samuel said, that she loved him, and she's the one who rescued him from the hand of Saul. And so she's kind of been a casualty of this whole thing. So Abner confers with the elders of Israel, and he reminds them that the Lord has promised this to David and assures them that this is the way they can be protected from their enemies. He sought to bring along the tribe of Benjamin. Why is the tribe of Benjamin such a big deal? Because that was Saul's tribe, right? So he's got to bring the tribe of Benjamin along. And he told David all that the plan involved. He came with 20 men to Hebron. David made a feast and is assured from Abner that all of Israel will be his, and he's sent away in peace. We're going to be told this again in verses 22 and 23 that we're going to get to in just a minute. But it's in peace. He's sent away. David, in this long wait, he seems to be working for peace. We've seen this in these relationships, these long-standing relationships that he's trying to reconcile with Michal and with Abner. So this is a great clue. This is a great insight for us. As we wait, we often tend to circle in selfish circles, right? We even see David doing this in a sense, right? He's doing really what's best for him. But pursuing peace is a biblically wise path. If ever you're at a crossroads and you're thinking, well, should I pursue peace here or not? The biblically wise path is to pursue peace. Why? Because, well, when we pursue peace, we show that we're children of God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. And so we should use our waiting to be at peace with all people. Use the time of waiting as an opportunity to love your enemies, to serve their needs, to refresh them. God used these weird circumstances that we don't fully understand to change Abner's heart. All of a sudden, Abner's ready to come full speed into David's world, to David's kingdom. And he probably is thinking, like all these other opportunists that we're meeting here, that, you know, hey, if I deliver all of Israel, then maybe I'll be the general in David's army. You know, maybe that's the case for Abner. But God had used this to bring him to David's side. And in the same way, God might be working in the hearts of your enemies, people that don't see things the way you do. He might be working in the hearts of those that you just don't get along with as you wait for him to come through in his promises to you. So the first lesson that we can learn here is, as we wait, is we can aim for peace. Aim for peace. What a great way to live in the waiting. You might think, well, I don't, you know, when is it right for me to step or move? Well, it's always the right time for peace. That's what we're learning here. That's what David's trying to put into practice. So closely related to that is the second lesson that we need to learn in the middle of chapter 3 here. It's that revenge under-delivers. Revenge under-delivers. So let's read the story here, beginning in verse 22 through the end of the chapter. Just then, so this is just after David sends Abner away in peace, just then the servants of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him came, it was told Joab, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he has let him go, and he has gone in peace. Then Joab went to the king and said, what have you done? Behold, Abner came to you? Why is it that you've sent him away so that he's gone? You know that Abner the son of Ner came to deceive you and to know you're going out and you're coming in and to know all that you're doing. So when Joab came out of David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the cistern of Sirah. And David did not know about it. And when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the midst of the gate to speak with him privately, and there he struck him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Asahel his brother. Afterward, when David heard of it, he said, I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner the son of Ner. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house, and may the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge or who's leprous or who holds a spindle or who falls by the sword or who lacks bread. So David and Abishai his brother killed Abner because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle at Gibeon. And then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and mourn before Abner. And King David followed the bier. They buried Abner at Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king lamented for Abner, saying, should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen. And all the people wept again over him. Then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was still yet day. But David swore, saying, God do so to me and more also, if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down. And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as everything that the people or the king did pleased all the people. So all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner the son of Ner. And the king said to his servants, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I was gentle today, though anointed king. These men, the sons of Zeruiah, are more severe than I. The Lord repay the evildoer according to his wickedness. So, revenge underdelivers. As Abner's leaving in peace, Joab pulls up with his entourage. They arrive from a raid with much spoil. Abner's already gone in peace. Can't emphasize that enough because the text does. When they arrive, Joab hears the news that Abner's been there in peace, and Joab's furious, and he questions the king, questions David. What are you doing? He's the enemy. He came to deceive you. He came to grab some intel on you. So this leads us to the Joab and Abner meeting. He sends messengers for Abner, but David didn't know about it. So Abner returns to Hebron. Now, if you've read your Old Testament, you know that Hebron is significant. We talked about this last time. It was significant for Abraham. It was significant for Caleb. And it was significant in Joshua 20 for another reason, because it was called a city of refuge. If you were ever, if you ever killed a person without intent, you could flee to a city of refuge and be safe from the avengers of blood. Okay? So this is a big deal in the Old Testament, because on the Old Testament law, it's like, what if you're like chopping wood one day and an axe head flies off the axe and hits somebody and kills them? What do you do? I mean, shouldn't you be put to death according to the Old Testament law? So they created God created these cities of refuge where people could go and be safe. And those avengers of blood couldn't come in there and kill them. So Joab invites Abner back to this city of refuge. And when they meet, he strikes him in the stomach and kills him out of revenge for his brother Asahel. And that was in 2 Samuel 2. And that was also in war. This was not in war, it was in peace, right? We've been told that three times, that Abner went away in peace, Abner went away in peace, Abner went away in peace. Joab says, hey, come back here, the king wants to talk to you, or whatever he said. So Abner returns, and Joab kills him. It was cold-blooded killing. So this leads to some distance between Joab and David. David hears of it and admits that he and his kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner. David calls down a fivefold curse. Did you hear that? May the guilt fall on Joab and his father's house, and there's curses related to discharge, leprosy, holding a spindle, falling by the sword, being hungry. This was a revenge killing for Asahel. But David tries to do good in this passage. He knows revenge underdelivers. And so look in verses 31 to 39, how many times all the people show up. That's a big theme here, because we're transitioning. Joab's acted one way. All the people are seeing something. So look at how many times all the people show up. We're told that all the people are called to mourn Abner. So Abner's buried and he receives a lament. All the people wept. David refuses to eat, even though all the people sought to persuade him. All the people noticed, and this pleased them. And all the people understood David had nothing to do with this. So David, an interesting twist, right? Joab kills Abner, and what's David's command to Joab? Tear your clothes and mourn. So he commands him, he forces Joab to mourn and to lament this death. And according to David, in Abner's death, a prince and a great man had fallen, and I was gentle, though anointed king. These men, these sons of Zeruiah, are more severe. The Lord repay them according to their wickedness. Now, on one level, you just want to be like, David, man, you bust up chops and take care of business. Why don't you just take care of Joab right here? And David's saying he's choosing to be gentle, even though he's anointed king. If you fast forward way into the future, into 1 Kings chapter 2, remember what David's final words were to Solomon? There's a thug named Joab. I didn't kill him all my days, but take care of business, son. And Solomon takes care of business. So it's real interesting. So the lesson here is the revenge underdelivers. But as David waits for God's timing, he chooses to be gentle. He chooses to step into that space. Of all things, to be described as gentle at the end of this passage. You may think when you're wronged in a situation that revenge might be the best option, right? I need to treat them just the way they're treating me. And what we're seeing modeled for us here is that as we wait, we need to step into gentleness. So if you're a child in this room and you have a brother or sister, so little kids, I'm talking to you. If you have a brother and sister, when a brother or sister wrongs you, is your gut reaction to be gentle or is it to revenge? Like, do you want to get them back? They hit me, I'm going to get them. Or they were mean to me, I'm going to be mean to them. Or is your response to be gentle? I mean, think about that, adults, for us too. When someone wrongs you, you know, whether it's purposefully or accidentally even, what's your gut reaction? Is it to step into gentleness? Or are you seeking to find an avenue for revenge quickly? I need to get back at them quickly. They wronged me. They're going to pay for this. We may think that revenge is the best path, but being gentle is preferable. Why? Because of, there's someone else in the Bible who was gentle. He was described this way. Jesus was described as gentle and lowly of heart. And we're told that as the Spirit is changing us, that the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, and self-control. And I know there's probably some men in this room who are thinking, gentle, that's just not in my nature. You're right, but if you're a believer, it is now, right? This is how you're to act. It's the fruit of the Spirit. You're called to be gentle. Now, that doesn't mean you're just milquetoast or whatever, but gentle. James 3 invites us to remember that the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, and gentle. Those are his three descriptions of wisdom that's from above. When we're stepping into a path that's characterized by wisdom, it's first pure. Yes, there's a holiness to it, a purity to it, but it's peaceable and it's gentle. Revenge won't work. It doesn't show that your trust is in God. It shows that your selfish interests are the most important thing in your world. That I'm going to make this right. They wronged me. That's what it's showing. It doesn't show, well, God's going to work this out. It's showing, I have to work this out because they're going to pay for what they did to me. So Romans 12 encourages us to leave room for the wrath of God to make things like this right. So Joab was so suspicious of Abner that he let folly get in the way of God's work to give David the kingdom. So he's going to kill Abner, and he's going to kill anyone who gets in the way of that plan. But God's plan couldn't even be thwarted by Joab and his vengeful plan. And David, in doing all this, David in acting this way, is pointing to his greater son, Jesus. That Jesus is the model of being gentle and not seeking revenge. Jesus is being crucified on the cross wrongly. And what does he say? Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do. He's gentle, lowly of heart. David looks a lot like Jesus as he demonstrates wisdom in his actions. Wisdom from above that's first pure but peaceable and gentle. Revenge underdelivers. If you devote your life to revenge, it is not going to give you what you think it's going to give you. You're not going to be satisfied. So the first lesson was, in the midst of the waiting, pursue peace. Second lesson, in the midst of the waiting, know that revenge underdelivers. Revenge is not the best way. Well, in chapter 4, we have the final piece, the final lesson. And we have to learn that we can't serve God doing what he condemns. We can't serve God doing what he condemns. So let me read chapter 4. When Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died at Hebron, his courage failed and all Israel was dismayed. Now Saul's son had two men who were captains of raiding bands. The name of the one was Baana, and the name of the other was Rechab, sons of Rimmon, a man of Benjamin from Beeroth. For Beeroth also is counted as part of Benjamin. The Beerothites fled to Gittim and have been sojourners there to this day. Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled, and she fled in her haste. And in her haste, he fell and became lame, and his name was Mephibosheth. Now the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, Rechab and Baana, set out, and about the heat of the day, they came to the house of Ishbosheth as he was taking his noonday rest. And they came into the midst of the house as if to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and Baana, his brother, escaped. When they came into the house, as he lay on his bed in his bedroom, they struck him and put him to death and beheaded him. And they took his head and went by the way of Arabah all night and brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron. And they said to the king, "Here's the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord, the king, this day on Saul and his offspring." But David answered Rechab and Baana, his brother, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity, when one told me, "Behold, Saul is dead," and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house on his bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth? And David commanded his young men, and they killed them and cut off their hands and feet and hanged them beside the pool at Hebron. And they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner at Hebron. So I'm sure you're reading this going, what in the Sam Hill? This is nuts. Thank God I'm not an Israelite or something. You know, like, who? This is insane. So our final section, the craziness continues, right? This is still a waiting game. Remember, we were told last time, 5 years David was king. And 5 years into that, that's when Abner set up Ishbosheth as king. So 5 years reigning over the house of Saul. Now 2 years, Ishbosheth is king. So we're now like 7 years into David's reign. He's still not king. God still has not fulfilled his promise. This is a waiting game. And in the waiting game, people get crazy when they have to wait. And this point here, we can't serve God doing what he condemns. So Ishbosheth learns that Abner's dead and his courage fails. And we meet these two men who were captain of the raiding bands, Rechab and Baana. We also meet, which I think it seems logical to introduce us to Mephibosheth here. Right, we're going to talk about Mephibosheth in chapter 9 entirely. That's what 2 Samuel 9 is about. After David becomes king, after the ark comes in, after God gives him a promise, after he gets rid of some enemies, then we have, hey, I made a promise to Jonathan. How am I going to keep that? Well, it seems this is going to be the last we'll hear of Saul until chapter 9. So we have to be introduced to Mephibosheth here in verse 4. So these two men, Rechab and Baana, they set out in the heat of the day. They come to Ishbosheth's house as he was resting. They go in and act like they're going to make a sandwich, right? They go in and get some wheat, right? See if they can get some wheat. They're going to make a sandwich, and they stabbed him in the stomach. And then they escape. And then the grueling scene is recapped in verse 7. Verse 7 is just a recap of how this all took place, right? They came in, they struck him, they put him to death, they beheaded him, and then they carried his head all the way to Arabah and then on to David at Hebron. And they come in and announce, yo, king, guess what? There's great news. Here's Ishbosheth's head, the son of Saul who sought your life. The Lord has avenged our Lord, the king, this day from Saul and his offspring. The Lord has done this great thing. And look at David's response. He's less than impressed, right? He reminds them that it's not henchmen who rescue and redeem him. Right? It's not like thugs who have given David the kingdom. It's the Lord. The Lord's the one who's redeemed him out of every adversity. It's the Lord. When he got news that Saul was dead, the messenger thought that he was bringing good news, but David seized him and killed him. And now these guys, these wicked men, they've killed a righteous man in his house on his own bed. And David said, am I not going to require blood from you? So David commanded his young men, and they killed them. They cut off their hands and feet, which they'd used to commit the murder, and they hung them beside the pool so that everyone would know. And Ishbosheth received a burial with Abner in Hebron. So, what's going on in chapter 4? Well, you might think, I'd never do anything like that. And right, you might not in that way. But this is a classic case of using our theology to pretty up the fact of our sin. Using something that we believe that God wants us to do, and we're making it all squeaky clean because, well, hey, this is what God wants for me. So here's how we do this all the time, right? Well, yeah, I don't love this person because of their lifestyle of sin they lead. We actually let stuff like that, garbage like that, come out of our mouths. When we're called to love our enemies, when we're called to love all kinds of people, we'll actually say stuff like, well, I don't love that person because of the lifestyle they lead. And it's heresy. God forbid. And it's the same thing that's going on here, right? Hey, the Lord's avenged your enemies. Here's the head of Ishbosheth. And David's saying, that's not how my Lord redeems enemies. That's not how my Lord is handing the kingdom over to me. He redeems me out of every adversity. I don't need thugs like you doing my dirty work. So we use theology to cover it up. Or we say stuff like, well, of course, I was justified to do this because they're such a wicked person. Really? You're justified to walk in sin because of how someone else acts? And that's what's going on here, right? They're killing someone in his house in the middle of the day. Not even in the middle of a war. And they're doing it under the guise of, God's anointed you king. Can't we just kill? And David's saying, no. This is not right. So, we're not any different than Rechab and Baana. We just need to get that straight right now. We do this. We use what we believe about God to justify our sin. And we'll even say that, you know, like, well, I was right to do this because of this. We're not any different. They defended a ruthless killing as God avenging David over his enemies. No, it wasn't God avenging. It was just you being stupid and sinning and killing someone. So as we wait on God to come through in his promises, we can't serve him doing what he condemns. We can't live a life of hate and say, well, it's justified because of what, they're sinners. We can't do that because he's called us to love. If he's called us to hate, then yeah. And I'm not saying like you don't, you know, speak out against sin or things, but we actually say things like, I'm just not going to love that person because of how they live. And you're not called to do that. In fact, if that's your heart, you're not even a believer. That's what 1 John says. Okay, so that's not me. Just read the book of 1 John. You can't say you love God who you haven't seen and hate your brother who you can see. Can't. Okay, so we gotta be careful that we're not doing this. We take matters into our own hands rather than waiting on the Lord's timing. And David's seen enough. As the Lord lives, God's the one who redeems us out of every adversity. So what it boils down to here in chapter 4 is your confidence and trust as you wait in him? Is it in God? Are you grateful for God and his care? Are you confident that no matter what adversity you get in, God's going to redeem you? David's saying, it doesn't matter if Ish-bosheth reigns another 20 years, my Lord will redeem me out of every adversity. I don't need you doing my dirty work because I have the Lord on my side. Is that your confidence? Do you have that kind of grateful confidence, especially as we step into a turbulent political season? That if God allows someone that I don't think should be elected to be elected, the Lord will redeem me out of every adversity. And he's with me. That'll be enough. I'll survive. I get heaven someday. Is this your confidence? We can't serve God doing what he condemns. Don't use this as a step. Don't use the adversity as a stepping stone to exalting yourself and stepping into something he's called you not to do. But use it as a springboard to say, hey, the Lord's on my side. He's with me, and he will redeem me out of every adversity. So I'm gonna aggressively walk in what he said, what he wants me to do. I'm gonna serve him, and I'm not gonna do what he has condemned. So in conclusion, as we wrap this up, three lessons that we can learn waiting for the Lord's timing. That we should aim for peace as we wait. That revenge under-delivers. Revenge promises you, man, this is going to make everything all right. And it never does. And we can't serve God doing what he condemns. So as you think about how we can live while we wait for the Lord's timing, you might think, there's no way on earth I can do this. It's impossible. And yes, I would admit, left to yourself, it is. You can't walk out of here this morning and say, I'm just going to be a more patient person. I'm going to gut this out on my own. Because like me, like David, and every other person in the history of the world, you're going to blow it. It's not going to work. You can't measure up. That's why we are all sinners. We can't do this. But what if I told you that there was really good news, that your heart could be changed? And as a result, because your heart's changed, the way you live can be changed through Jesus Christ. I mean, this is the great good news, that you can live in such a way that is more characterized by him and not so much about you. This is the basics of what the good news is. You just admit that you can't measure up to God's standard. That's how this begins. You just admit, God, there's no way I can live the way you want me to live. I can't pull it off. I can't measure up. And you give up. I'm going to quit trying to do all this in my own strength. And I'm going to put all my trust in you, Jesus, as my Lord and Savior. You're the one who's done this. You were the one who was always gentle. You were the one who was never seeking revenge. You were the one who was always doing what the Father wanted. and never using it as a cover-up to do what he condemns. That you were the one who did this. I mean, you might think, well, it's just impossible for me to live that way. Yeah, and Jesus did the impossible, right? He rose from the dead, and he conquered everything that might keep you from really living. So he's conquered the impossible for you. He's done it. So today, will you believe in him? Will you find his power and enablement gives you the strength to live? Yes, in your own strength, you're going to blow it. It's impossible for you to do this. But in his strength, with him living in you, you can be gentle, because he is. You can be patient, not just going after revenge, because that's his heart. You can thread the needle of serving him by not doing what he condemns. You can do this in Christ. You can do this. So if you're a believer, this resurrection power is yours. The Holy Spirit lives inside you. He's working fruit in your heart that is full of peace, that's full of gentleness. And peace, gentleness over wisdom, gentleness through wisdom, and serving God by doing what he says, they seem like elusive ways to live. You can even think now, well, I just blow it so much, I'm so selfish. But you can wait on him by living this way. So seek peace. Live that way with others. Seek peace. Don't harbor grudges for years. Just let go and seek peace. Let it be that relating to you is the most peaceful thing that anybody in this world could know. And be gentle. What would it look like for you to be gentle? I'm closely related to gentleness is that concept of meekness. And Jesus said, blessed are the meek. Why? Because they will inherit the earth. I mean, this is incredible that Jesus would say this is so like at the core of who you are meant to be, that you're going to inherit everything. It's a way of living. This way of peace, this way of gentleness is a way of living that's laced with promises from God. You're not going to pursue this and say, oh man, I'm just so full of regret. I was so gentle and peaceful like Jesus all the days of my life. So disappointing. You're not going to do that. And that last point, just don't use your theology as a cover-up for idolatry. That's really the issue, right? Don't say that you serve God and then deploy yourself in ways that simply serve or even worship your selfish interests. That's what's going on there, right? They have selfish interests. They want David to be king. God wants David to be king, right? But their selfish interest leads them to kill. And David's saying, listen, I'm going to choose gentleness. I'm going to choose peace. I'm going to choose to put all my chips on the one who can redeem me out of every adversity. And man, look at what happens in chapter 5. David's going to become king over the entire nation next week. So this is an incredible opportunity for us to live here in the moment as we wait. As we wait. There's all kinds of living for us to do there. So let's step into these lessons that we may glorify and enjoy God forever.